Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had Maya Gayad. Maya is a partner at ID4 Ventures, an early stage investor backing European startups and venture funds. With close to a decade operating in venture, Maya has risen through the ranks at ID4 from analyst to partner, shaping the firm's investment strategy and supporting founders at critical growth stages. Via ID4, Maya has a dual perspective as both a fund of funds as well as direct investor, giving her deep insights into capital flows across the VC ecosystem. She is passionate about founder resilience, market adaptation, and disciplined fundraising, particularly in today's evolving investment climate. Based across Paris and London, Maya and ID4 are helping shape the future of European tech investment. In today's episode, we talked about how the VC industry is going through a huge change and we're seeing the death of the middle.
It's happened in every maturing industry. So even when you talk to early stage founder and you give them this valuation, and sometimes they don't accept it because another VC give them a higher valuation and they go for it.
How diligence is taking longer, whether you're a founder or an emerging manager, and why being entrepreneur friendly means actually putting yourself in the founder's shoes.
I like funds where you have one of the founder, when you have one of the founder that did the company himself.
If as an investor, you think you could do better than the founder, then you shouldn't really invest. And how the founder is actually in the car driving, and so investors should be in the backseat paying attention.
You can tell him maybe, oh, take this shortcut. But if he needs to pick up something on the way where it makes sense for him to go the other way, you should just trust him sometimes.
It's always worth understanding what deals you miss out on and why we need to stop killing innovation by over-indexing on the metrics.
And now today is more about, okay, you're building something, but meanwhile, what kind of revenue are you able to? So now we're seeing more like smart tracker. It's like all the data that you're actually being able to capture while you're building your business.
How accelerators excel when they're providing talent and community. And Maya's contrarian opinion.
Healthcare for middle class people doesn't really serve a lot today. And we should, as a human, do more there.
Let's get straight into it. Hi, guys. Whilst I've got you for a second, I thought I'd reintroduce myself. My name's Arish. I am the host of Nothing Ventured, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture industry go round. I'm also the founder of Emerge One, a consultancy that provides fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups from seed to Series B and beyond. I really hope you enjoy the podcast, and if you do, we'd love it if you could join the tens of thousands of others by subscribing on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And if you want to have a conversation with me, feel free to reach out on LinkedIn or X. I'm always happy to have a bit of a chat. Right, let's get back into it. Maya, really great to have you in the studio with me. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I wanted to dive straight in. You know, ID4 allocates directly into early stage ventures, as well as into other VC funds as a fund of funds, having just fully deployed fund one. So can you talk a little bit about the state of the market for venture funds raising at the moment and how you see things changing? For example, you and I had previously talked about how in early 2024, literally everyone was trying to fundraise, whether it was a startup, whether it was a VC fund, which led to actually at that time, and we saw this in the market as well, just not a huge amount of capital being deployed compared to previous periods. So I assume that many funds may have found it difficult to raise during that period. So I guess, you know, first of all, what is the state of market? And do you think we're going to see some consolidation over the course of the next few years?
Yeah, I think already the VC industry is undergoing a major transformation with fundraising, mm-hmm. concentrated on dominant few player, mm-hmm. Mid-class a bit struggling and forcing more the small funds that they have like a niche or like, you know, when you have like a new talent leaving big companies and they're seeing some good opportunity, they're doing either their own fund mm-hmm. and they're seeing something different or people coming from the ecosystem. So there is still money coming to VC, mm-hmm. but it's more consolidated to the big firms that they show their ability to exit. Mm-hmm. And some LPs are just sitting with the middle class one where like, what about the return? Mm-hmm. What's your ability for us to generate a DPI? Mm-hmm. Especially that for some fund, it was more like we put the money in the market and we recycle this money.
Yeah.
So as long as this money is not recycling, mm-hmm. some investors are just sitting on the side waiting
yeah.
for it.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I say there is still money going, but mostly for for the big one. And for us, we did some investment in Europe. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that some people still are able to fundraise, mm-hmm. because they have different strategy. Mm-hmm. So in Europe, mostly the fund of fund, either you are like family offices,
yeah.
you are institutional,
yeah.
Or you are a family from the region that's want to give private back to the region some nature, yeah. or something.
Yeah.
So allocation is totally different.
Mm.
So what makes sense for private money doesn't make sense for government money. Some funds, they still need to exist because they are hiring people. These people are paying their tax. Mm. They are you're lowering the deployment,
mm.
and you need to be able to give the new tech and the founders like the capital to do something different than before.
Yeah.
Is it that the best case scenario for some private investor to exit their money? Not really. We see as well that even in the US, last year you had 750 unicorn.
Mm-hmm.
And the IPO market today is driven by 5.
Yeah.
So is it to be fair, it should be driven by 20?
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, the tech allocation is important because it's moving 50% of the growth in the US, that there are like 5 tech companies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And these 5 tech companies are sitting a loss of on their balance sheet, where they are just looking at the market and saying which company we should acquire,
yeah,
next.
Yeah.
Because if we start losing revenue for all this new company, for all this, like already if our existing user are now using a lot of AI agent,
mm.
so instead of you're getting from Salesforce 10 seats, you're getting 5 seats.
Mm.
Because you have so much AI agent that's helping you to be more productive.
More efficient, yeah.
They were like, okay, maybe I should buy this small company that is actually making me lose some revenue. So at the same time, they bring it because they can.
Yeah.
This company, they can.
Yeah. And I mean, like, they can in the US, when we don't see as much of that in Europe and certainly in UK, because we don't have those massive companies with those sort of balance sheets in the same way, certainly not in the tech industry as compared to the US.
So we're seeing more M&A actually, yeah. in Europe.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
even in the US.
Yeah, so it's either, I mean, what we tend to see, I guess, in the UK is financial sponsors, right? So it's private equity that comes in and consolidates.
Even now, private equity are struggling.
They're struggling as well because they don't have any other...
Yeah, the death of the middle, so...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is it, right? The death of the middle. So the private equity, like, they're struggling because... Again, to your point, if that IPO and exit market is not substantially there or has declined or is not improving, then there is no one to sell onto in order to realize, you know, the funds. And that's where everything gets stuck. And I'm curious, though, you mentioned, you know, the death of the middle, obviously, but also presumably... when ID4 was deploying its fund of funds, and I appreciate that sort of now closed off. What is your take on sort of emerging managers and how they are faring? Because I get the impression that emerging managers have started to struggle a bit more over the last couple of years in terms of trying to raise and close their initial funds.
Well, I, to be fair, as everyone knows that due diligence is taking more time,
mm-hmm.
either if you are a founder or if you are a VC.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Speed
due diligence on emerging manager is taking more time.
Mm.
Sector specific focus are increasing. If you want to have a fund that exposed to sector showing growth or a high potential,
mm.
you are someone here that is able to fundraise, especially if you show that you are coming from this industry, you know? And we're seeing new faces actually in emerging managers, people that they have a new way to adapt.
Mm. A lot of SPVs rather than sort of traditional fund structures. Yeah.
People that are being now more able to be able to monitor the market dynamic,
mm-hmm.
to see how we can create SPV, how the exit environment shift, how the fundraising shift, maybe reduce the size of our fund. Maybe we don't need to have like 50 people.
Mm.
We can reduce. So respect for the people that they are just trying to adapt to what the market is. Mm. So there's definitely some money still coming for this niche emerging manager that they are seeing things different. And at the same time, if you are able to show that you are being able to get into the winner, everyone will give you money.
Yeah, but I think, and it comes back to your point around DPI, right? Like, so the thing that I fear, if I can put it that way, is like we had a lot of emerging managers launch in sort of 2020, 2020, well, 19, 2021 vintages. And obviously there was a lot of froth in the market. And, you know, if they'd raised from institutional capital, but they're not been necessarily sensible allocators, or maybe, you know, got caught up in the hubris of those sort of 2-3 years, now when it comes to trying to realize some of those investments, that's going to be harder. And actually that means that, to your point, performance is impacted, their ability to then go out and raise fund two or fund three is impacted because they're not able to show the performance in fund one or the earlier fund, right? Because, you know, if you've gone into a company, you know, in a frothy market where, you know, valuations were at 30, 40x when they should have been at 10, 15x, it's going to be harder to kind of show those markups and returns. And so I wonder whether we're going to see a lot of emerging managers that came out in those earlier years now starting to struggle now because those performance metrics aren't there. And then whether institutional investors and LPs maybe sort of look at the whole emerging manager market kind of as one market and say, well, we got our fingers burnt because we invested in these emerging managers. We're going to stick, you know, to the more established, longer term, larger funds.
Yeah. And honestly, to be fair, it's when you do early stage, it's hard to see the up down to upmark your fund actually. Mm-hmm. Especially that this company, either they are like still growing, doing their R&D, still looking to fundraise next. So upmarking your fund is a bit hard for some emerging. But at the same time, if you show that at least this company, after your valuation, they were able to raise at a higher valuation that makes sense, and they have the signaling effect, it's kind of like, you know, I don't have to go and ask an emerging manager, what's your fund performance? I would ask him, which company are driving your performance?
Sure.
You know, because if he's involved in this company, they know some stuff that sometimes doesn't really look sexy from outside.
Or they haven't raised an
exactly,
round,
so or they are into something big or they are going to sign a big contract or something. But at the same time, the market is doing its own cleaning.
Mm.
So this is why we're seeing that, as we were talking about the death of the middle, it's happened in every maturing industry.
Mm.
So even when you talk to early stage founder and you give them this valuation, and sometimes they don't accept it because another VC give them a higher valuation and they go for it. I mean, it's fair if you're able to show that you actually deserve this valuation.
Yeah, if you can create the value. Yeah,
yeah, if you increase the value for your next round, please, I'm happy. I am your investor. But some investors, they were just giving it without taking into consideration the pressure that you're going to put on the founder for his next round.
Mm.
And if he's not going to be able to put it, and how bad you're going to go and tell him maybe not to fundraise currently because you don't want to like have a down round or a flat round. So you have to go to your investor and say, well, I wasn't disciplined enough. And you know what? A great founder will always... Definitely any founder would love a high valuation, but a great founder will always understand the risk
Of too high a valuation.
Of too high valuation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he knows when you sit with him and you do the math and you explain the risk, he got it. There's no better way to do a due diligence on a founder more than how he sees this and how he analyzes it and how he wants to go for what makes sense. Unless I mean you're a second time founder, you just need the money, you have the vision and you want to just go and make it big. Fair enough.
But even those can fail. Like, I mean, there's no guarantee, right?
But we're seeing them today in the US, you know, like they can go from big tech company, raise high valuation because your people are investing in them.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's interesting. I have a couple of stories, which I think I may have even mentioned on the podcast in the past. So we had a conversation with one founder who had raised, you know, we had launched during the pandemic. It was in the health tech space, was booking quite significant revenue, sort of million a month in revenue because, you know, it was very much needed. took a check from a large investor at, you know, a frothy valuation, hasn't needed the cash again, and that was in 2021, hasn't needed the cash again until now, went back to market in 24, not much runway, but was looking to beat that valuation. In the meantime, their revenues had dropped significantly, you know, down to, you know, $20,000 a month or whatever it was. And but we're still expecting to beat that valuation. I said, there's no way, right? Like, if you want to continue this business in this way, you are going to have to accept that you're going to achieve a lower valuation. And that's fine, right? Like, they came in at froth and okay, if you want to survive, this is what you're going to need to do. I don't actually know what they ended up doing. But then another business we work with, the founder's very clear. He'd rather take, you know, they're not massively diluted. He'd rather take a lower valuation today that gives him optionality. So if he wants to exit for nine figures rather than a billion, he can do that, right? Because if he values today at 50 instead of 100, when it gets to the 100 million, everyone's actually pretty happy. They've made a decent return on their money. And everyone can carry on. I want to switch tack a little bit because you've worked both within a venture with the principals of ID4 and then obviously launched ID4 as well. So in your experience, how do you define being entrepreneur friendly as an early stage investor? And this goes to a little bit about what we just talked about, even about valuations. But and at what point does providing support and guidance potentially cross into stifling a founder's creativity and autonomy? And how do you make sure you get to the right balance?
So as it's starting from all down to all high, you can have different conversation with people, mm-hmm. with investor. Mm-hmm. So when you're still junior, people sometimes they feel more free to tell stuff around you.
Sure.
And you see, and with the growing in the industry, you see it different. Mm-hmm. And for us, as we do fund of funds and as we do direct investment, I always like to talk to founders. Mm-hmm. Even to ask him about, like, what's your experience with this fund? Mm-hmm. And what was your feedback with this one? Because, you know, everyone tried to show that they are the best, mm-hmm. which is good. Like, we all dress up nicely when we want to go out. But the thing is, how close are you with your founders? Because entrepreneur friendly is something that we need. Mm-hmm. I like funds where you have one of the founder, when you have one of the founder that did the company himself, which is the case for us because I didn't do a company from scratch, but we have two partner that they did the company from scratch. And sometimes if I'm being a bit harsh, it will be like about the momentum or like mm-hmm. the pace is not enough. They were like, we are founders. We put ourselves in their shoes. We know how does it go. Mm. And this is very important to put yourself in the founder's shoes. Mm. And at the same time, when our industry at early stage is bet on exceptional founder, it's all about their capability, the capability to hire the right team, the restraint, and the capability to execute as well. Mm. And sometimes you have to be on demand hand-on with your founders. You need one partner that actually kind of did a company before. Mm-hmm. One is more on the operational. Mm-hmm. Because if you think that you're going to build the product better, don't invest. Mm-hmm. If you think you're better than the founder.
Yeah.
Starting from there, like, don't invest.
Yeah.
But are we talking about different founders? So we're talking about first-time founder, second-time mm-hmm. founder. We're talking about people that they just like finish university. They found something very, very smart and they go to build it. You don't expect to these people to be able to handle when they raise 1-2 million, mm-hmm. to be able to manage the same 5-10 million in their bank account.
Yeah, sure.
Or 20-30 million bank account to do the right balance sheet. You don't expect that from it. And you know, the founders, at the end of the day, they are like people. Mm-hmm. They are people like us. Some of us are introverts. Some of us are extroverts. Some of us are really being able to talk all day long with other people. Some people, they just like to sit on their laptop and work for hours and don't bother me. So some founders that are able to fundraise, to hire the right people, to sell the product. And some people, they need help.
Yeah.
And some of them, this is their first time building a company. Some of them, they did work for corporate before, so they know how to avoid some mistake. They already have some network. For us, it's come with what we say always on demand, hands on. So if you call me saying, I'm having a hard time to hire this, can you know people in the market that maybe are hiring for the same or, you know, some people leaving to do it. And at the same time, as we were like, what we did with like one of our portfolio with the finance strategy, you know, telling them that you need to hire a CFO while you're getting to the final one. Meanwhile, you need to report, you know, because reporting for 500K that you raise with friends and family is not the same reporting for private investor, is not the same reporting for venture capital. So it requires a different set of people to come and to do that for you. How you can improve your margin pricing is something that, you know, some founders, you see them, they are very like decent with the pricing.
They're very scared of overcharging.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And we were like, no, actually, you can price it more.
Yeah.
And you don't want like, this is our stuff where like you can really discuss it with the founder. Where you say we're not talking product, actually. Product is their thing. Yeah. You know, building the right product, is it for them? And how to do cap table cleaning, you know? You take some friends and family ticket, you take your old boss that invested in your company, but maybe he's not the right person to keep him all along on your cap table.
Well, so this is, okay, this opens a couple of really interesting things up. So actually, so the conversation, Maya, that you're referring to is, which is how we met, was I came in and actually did not realize or was not, you know, was not expecting the conversation to be what it was. So this was you and one of the managing partners from ID4 and one of your portfolio companies. And it was a really interesting conversation from my perspective, because actually, as investors, you were really guiding the founder as to, from a financial perspective, what you thought would be valuable for the business. Like, you know, you were essentially pitching my services on my behalf. Not that you were doing it on my behalf, but you were really explaining why it was necessary. And I could tell that the founder hadn't really thought about this. But when he got into some of the things that he was thinking about and some of the issues that he's had in the business, not issues, but some of the challenges, right? Because it's a very small team. It was really clear that actually he hadn't thought about it, but my gosh, could he, you know, he could really use that support. And I think a lot of founders, what we tend to find is a lot of founders need to have that outside gap because they are often overly, you know, very focused on product.
And it's hard for them to delegate, actually.
Exactly,
you know?
Right?
It's like their company and now I should delegate, you know, they kind of like, should I delegate now? I'm giving it too early. Should I be busy all the time doing stuff? And this is where you actually can tell them it's important. There's 24 hours per day. You have to sleep at least 7. Let's keep work out, life, etc. So you need to delegate at one time when you want to like scale bigger.
So one, and I think they're actually, I think they may be one of your investee funds, but one of the partners at a fund that I know very well, you know, he said to me once, you know, he was talking about a founder and he said, he's really great at building revenue, but he's not doing very well at building the business. And what he meant by that was revenue is great. And obviously revenue is the lifeblood of any company, right? But building the business is a different discipline, right? That is about hiring people, delegating, putting in processes, putting in systems, putting in repeatable processes, especially, right? Because ultimately when you come to exit, that's what people are buying. They want to buy a set of repeatable processes that they can just plug and play into whatever they're doing, or, you know, even if they bought it outright and just want to run it themselves, that is what they're buying into. And I think, you know, some of the best investors that I know understand how to build the business, how to challenge the founder when they do need that support, but doing it in the right way, as you guys did in that instance. But equally also being able to stand back and let the founder run, because at the end of the day, irrespective of your experience, my experience, anyone else's, the founder is in that business 24 hours a day, right? Yeah. Like they know what's happening.
Yeah, we always say that the founder is the one driving the car. You're just in the backseat.
Yeah.
You can tell him maybe, oh, take this shortcut. But if he needs to pick up something on the way where it makes sense for him to go the other way, you should just trust him sometime, you know? You can give him tips. And it's very important how to keep scaling the winner. You know, we need to create the best-in-class portfolio and we need to help them as well. And at the same time, when you work with... When your client as well, and we always forget, we always put it on the investor side, but if you're selling for enterprise, we know really well what could look good for an enterprise side and how to make it happen. How for some enterprise, they don't want to work with like early stage startup because it's too risky. Don't know how long they're going to stay in the market. So
And lead times, right?
Yeah. Like,
and which has a massive impact. And founders always underestimate the amount of time it takes to close an enterprise client, right? We all know, or we know that...
They are good ARR, but it takes time.
It takes 9 months or 12 months or more, right? And you have to go through procurement and you have to go through lots of hoops. And, you know, I think a lot of founders are unprepared because they're so excited about their product, right? This is a product, like you need this product. This, why are you not buying it? But that isn't how corporations work, right? They're slow. They are very conservative. They're
being pitched by hundreds of companies.
And they're being pitched by hundreds of companies. So no, I mean, I think, you know, that sort of, and that whole question of founder friendly, and we've swung, I think, so, you know, again, 19, 20, 21, 22, it was sort of probably over founder friendly in the sense, just let the founder get on with things. Which actually is an abrogation of like your duties as an investor as well, or potentially as a director, right? If you're sitting on the board, yes, you've got to give the founder autonomy, but you also want to be able to give them the direction, because ultimately you have a fiduciary responsibility, right? You have to be able to protect your and other shareholders' rights, as well as the company, you know, and do what is in the best interest of the company first and foremost. And sometimes that means sitting down with a founder and saying, hold on a second, actually, like, this is great, but in this area, you need to go in this direction, right? So I think the other thing with all of this, you know, because we're talking about sort of the earlier stages, but as startups start maturing from seed to later stages, the emphasis very much, and you know, you talked about this, shifts from storytelling to demonstrating tangible results, right? So at early stages, about the founder, can they execute, can they build a team, you know, like what is their narrative?
Do you love the story? Do you buy the story, actually?
Exactly, right? Like, and you know, a lot of investors that I know at pre-seed, seed, early stages, you're taking a bet on, okay, can I visualize what the founder is saying? Do I buy into their story and do I think that they can execute? But I think it can be quite confusing for founders to figure out what to focus on with some metrics that are really important for the business, but not for investors and vice versa, right? So the North Star for what the business is trying to track and what they want to achieve, maybe, you know, hopefully will never be misaligned, but maybe different from what investors want to see. So what do you believe to be the most critical sort of metrics for a startup to start tracking as they start maturing? And especially as they start looking to attract investors beyond that initial narrative. And again, just to finish off, like, and to give an example, exactly to your point, where, you know, the company that I had talked to that had taken the high valuation a few years ago that didn't want to take a down round, when I said, you know, the likelihood is you're going to, you know, and they had a term sheet at half the price, half the valuation as that initial round. I said, you should have considered that. And their response was, if all they're looking at the metrics, they're the wrong investor. Because she was saying that they need to look at the narrative and the vision. But the problem was the business was 3-4 years in. So it's harder to then buy into just a narrative and vision at that point, right?
Yeah, I mean, as a founder, if you have the capability to choose your investor, it's great.
If you can, yeah.
If you can.
Yeah.
If you can't, while you're building the big image, you just have to take the money that makes sense for you while you're proving that this is the technology.
Yeah, exactly.
Or this is the product is going to work. Yeah. And, you know, I always say it's so interesting to see the data on, because we all talk all day long about the winner and the early investor, et cetera, to see who are the funds that actually pass on the winner.
Mm. Yeah, the anti portfolio. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. To see as well who passed on this winner and what were their excuse as well, because it's interesting to see how much you're missing on the big winner as well. Mm. To go back on the founder's thing, actually today there is money still coming to founders. There is still money coming to founders that they are being able to adapt to the change. So today, for some, you know, like the last 2 years, everyone was talking about like revenue. Are you making revenue? Back in time, it's about like, oh, go build the product. Revenue is Series A. Yeah. We don't care for it now.
Get consumers, get users. We'll figure it out down the track.
Now today is more about, okay, you're building something, But meanwhile, what kind of revenue are you able to? So now we're seeing more like smart tracker. It's like all the data that you're actually being able to capture while you're building your business. And what kind of as well, if we need to push company now to become more profitable, I think the last of thing is that we have to stop killing innovation in geography.
Yeah.
So if you are founders in healthcare, and healthcare, let's say in Europe, is taking very long term for you to be able to onboard hospital, and you've been called by hospital, let's give any reason, in Saudi, it's a big market in hospital, you know, and they were being able to onboard them and show revenue because you spoke to one group that they have many hospitals and they can actually onboard you in less time. And that can make great revenue from you. So now founders were like, okay, there is something that I may be able to sell outside of my geography to show that actually people like my product. Mm. And this is where like we're seeing more founders that are thinking outside of the box. That could be something. Could be something going selling for the US because they are early adopter in technology. We have one company that actually wanted to work with Mercedes in Europe. They were like, oh, you're still early stage startup. They got Mercedes in the US. When they came back to Europe, they actually onboard them.
That's hilarious. So Mercedes Europe, which would have been head office, refused, but US were willing to take a bet.
And you know, it's I don't blame anyone. Sometimes it could be the person in charge.
Sure.
You know, sometimes it could be some people like Chris, you know, and as everything is moving, our ability as well should be moving in so many sectors with like regulation in hospital or regulation in any other sector as well.
Yeah.
By as well saying for companies, not only, oh, stay in the UK, stay in the UK.
Yeah. But so in terms of kind of what these founders should be thinking about, like, so, you know, they're early stage to your point, you know, they may not have booked lots of revenue yet. But they're being told you need to focus on, well, often they're being told to focus on revenue and cash discipline and efficiency, which are good things and not bad things. And ultimately, you know, the value of a business is the present value of its future cash flows discounted back at an appropriate rate. You know, as every finance geek out there will know, but when you're a founder and you're trying to build a business, you can't just focus on revenue is one metric, but it isn't the only metric. So like, how do you think about that at ID4? So the businesses you've backed at early stage and are kind of graduating out, like what, and of course it changes from industry to industry and so on and so forth. But, you know, how do you think about that? How do you help founders address the question of what it is that they need to be showing to be able to then go out and grow and potentially raise from later stage funds?
I mean, it all depends at the end of the day what you're building, who are your target clients at the end of the day. So you can't just like, you know, and this is where it's come to all like about like a new startup doing open source, very closed source, and you're letting everyone train on your model. So it makes sense or doesn't make sense. There is technology today is changing so much. What's used to be unsexy is sexy now. Back in time, data scientists, no one used to talk to them. Now there are people fundraising, actually, and everyone needs them, actually.
Yeah.
So we're changing a lot of difference here. And at the end of the day, if you're investing in the right people, do you know what their vision for the product? You know. So at the same time, if you go and fundraise from investors that they are pushing their agenda to you,
it's not going to work.
It's not going to work. Yeah. Are we want to build a company that scale? Yes. Are we want to invest in company that they are able to generate revenue? Yes. To kill competition? Yes. But everything has the right time.
Mm.
Building the first prototype had the right time. Being the founder selling had the right time because you understand more the product. You see the feedback of your clients. And all of that will make you work on the product.
Mm.
And sometimes making revenue at certain level, it doesn't make sense because instead of you being just focusing on that, and some of the time you take the wrong client where you end up churn actually.
Yeah.
Or you feel like, oh, maybe I should take this big client.
Yeah.
It's good for revenue. But maybe your product is not ready for this.
Because I think...
So churning this one is going to be huge red flag on you when everyone's like, okay, so your product doesn't really actually work.
Whereas if you'd focus on getting the product right first, you'd have found the right customers down the track and had less of those problems. And I think I remember, I think it was the founder of Superhuman. I can't remember now for sure, but I'm pretty sure it was the founder of Superhuman who actually said at one point they actually killed off 90% or whatever, a large number of their users and focused on like the 1,000 that were really loving the product and just doubled down on understanding what it was that they loved and building out the things, because those were the people that were not going to churn, right? They were going to be there for the journey and hopefully as early adopters, there would be others that are similar, would have similar sort of enthusiasm for the product. So that was an instance where, okay, they could have taken revenue from the additional, however many, 10,000 customers. I don't think it was as much as that, but however many it was.
I mean, this is where you are invested. If you're entrepreneurial friendly, you come and you tell the founders, you just tell him that, make sure that this client is not going to be churned in a few months for you. And he was like, oh, true. Yeah. It's small stuff. Here you're not managing him. You're just being close to the company and trying to help him. But if he wants to do the other thing, it's his company at the end of the day. If you're not happy, don't invest and don't do this business. Go invest in SME, buy them. Do something different.
Yeah.
But if you don't want to take what the founder is saying into feedback, and sometimes you even hear other investors on board pushing for their agenda on the board as well, which is not fair for some founder. And this is where you actually, as an investor, you come and you tell them, always check what the background of this investor.
Mm.
So to see if they're going to push you maybe to just stay in UK or just stay in France or just stay, don't go to Europe. So there is so much as well for you as a founder to learn, because it's your first company. You don't know the game.
Mm.
You feel like, okay, it's VC money. They come, they help.
There's a power dynamic.
Yeah,
right?
And I like this partner.
Yeah.
But sometimes this partner is not able to take the decision by himself. There's an IC behind. Mm. So, and there's other people deciding. And yes, some partners sometimes lose a deal because it didn't go through IC, And this is some game that you don't know what founders do all day long of their life. Yeah. They don't know what VC do all day long of their life, And this is where you actually just try to open their eyes on some stuff.
Yeah.
And as well, having the ability to rise enough money for you to make to not be able fundraising all the time.
Yeah.
Because fundraising game is a long one.
Yeah. Well, it's become longer, right? Like it's 6 to 9 months now to raise a round, and that's like 2/3 of your year, potentially gone, just fundraising. And that's time that you're not focused on building the product or building revenue or building the team. And you become a bit of an absentee parent because your team is like, why? Like, we're doing everything. Why is this guy off in San Francisco or in Europe or whatever? And, I think most people working with early stage businesses understand the dynamics of going out to fundraise. But I don't think many people appreciate just how time consuming and difficult that really is, and how much bandwidth it takes up of the founders, which means it's very difficult for them to the best founders are able to figure out how to balance the fundraise with the other priorities in the business, but especially for first time founders that can be incredibly difficult. I wanted to again just before we close off switch tack a little bit as well, because we've talked about accelerators and kind of where they sit. And I think you and I probably have some quite similar thoughts on this. But, there is a lot of information online, right, at the moment, especially there's podcasts like this, there's newsletters, there's content written on LinkedIn day in, day out. The startup ecosystem continues to evolve. So do you think that kind of traditional accelerators still hold significant value for entrepreneurs? Or are there specific sectors like, space tech, quantum computing, possibly even AI, right? The more nascent kind of technologies, and they're not necessarily new, but they're becoming more sort of significant as opposed to say 5 years ago, where accelerators continue to play a very strong role in kind of nurturing early stage companies. And how do you think they may adapt their models to remain relevant and provide real value to startups? Because my take has always been that a lot of accelerators, not all of them, you are buying, yes, you are buying a bit of brand, right, by being associated with them, but often they are taking quite hefty chunks of equity for not a huge amount of value from what I can, you know, from what I can see from the outside. So I'd love to get your kind of take on that.
Yeah, I mean, we're having better tech every day and we're all learning from it every day. And as we are bringing costs down, there is more use case that's coming out of technology today.
Yeah.
Do we need some accelerator? Yes, in some sector, as you're mentioning, space, for example, you know, like today in the US is really pushing for everything in space, for example. Yeah. And even they are pushing for no US company to come and innovate in the US and to bring all this technology. And for example, talent in space is very hard to find. Because we only had like 3 space company back in time, the big one, SpaceX, yep. Rocket Lab and Blue Origin.
Yeah.
So if you're building something today in space, it's hard for you to be able to attract talent because there's not a lot of them. Or if there are some of them, they are really high paid.
Yeah, because they're already, you know, the best talent.
You
is
know,
already
they are rare.
Taken.
You know,
yeah.
It's like you're buying something that is rare, and you know there's so much demand on it. When it's come to this, I would say yes, we need because there wasn't a lot of investment in space. Even now, we're seeing more dedicated space funds.
Yeah.
And space, it's very underestimated until you start talking to people in space. You figure out like, no, actually, this is a huge because with everything happening now in the space, you can do all this like a new drug discovery, orbit manufacturing,
scientific research,
space tourism, satellites and communication. It's huge.
Exactly that, right? I was thinking about like, so we got introduced to a business recently and like, you know, I was like, okay, space tech is about, okay, can we send more rockets out? Can we look at, mineral mining in space? How do we lower the cost of space tourism, for argument's sake? You know, space elevators in the future, maybe that's a thing that can happen. Probably not. I think the laws of physics currently would not allow it. But then we got introduced to a business, exactly as you say, that is looking at doing drug manufacturing in space. And I was like, okay, I hadn't even considered that was something that would lead to an incredible efficiency, which, you know, certainly this particular one would. And to your point, I guess where an accelerator potentially also comes into play is
Can like fast track your technology in the space, because it's like some of them, they either like they were part of SpaceX before, or like they know some people there, or they know, because you know in space there's some stuff that usually government tried inside and didn't went in public, and they know what could work, what doesn't work, and how like this is charge could be too expensive, or not.
Mm.
And having the right people in this space, and I would really say
the space community is important.
Talent
and community, exactly.
Yeah. So talent community is important. If you're doing something, let's say in compute, is important as well, because back in time we always thought that it's still early. Now we're figuring out that there is so much company, not so much, but there are some big companies now working on it.
Mm.
And we need to have this talent around. So I would say in some sector, yes. If you're doing another SaaS business, do you really need to know for someone to tell you how to fundraise? Do they really need to take 10% of your cap table?
Yeah.
And we're seeing sometimes with some founder, we're like, we did this mistake. We give so much for the accelerator that we went through back in time.
Mm.
Some of them, they really like, we still need them.
Mm.
You know, like you can't take a founder happiness when he received an email from YC that he got accepted.
Sure.
And all the experience that you live there. And when you see other founders doing something different and all of that. Yes, we need some of them. But as everything, stuff become very fashionable. It become very unfashionable. Then it depends. And especially if you think that you want this community, or you already did the company before, you know most of the VC that you want to talk to, you know which kind of KPI a Series A would be expecting from you. So you just go and build it by yourself.
Sure.
And you can use your business angel, you can use your VC to come and help. And today, you know, there's so much podcast, video.
Yeah.
Everything is public. You know, we've been living on open source for the last 10 years.
Exactly.
So there is so much to learn there. And if you want something that could work for you. So there is no here yes or no.
Yeah.
depends on what you're, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's what makes sense.
For you, for the business, yeah, and what
for
the
founders to arrive at Series A and they still have 30% of their cap table.
That's a problem.
Yeah. That's a problem.
Yeah. And we see that a lot. And I think that is, you know, I think founders don't necessarily understand that later stage dynamic, because I think what happens is at early stage they get excited, okay, we got accepted into accelerators, we got some angels, we got some, you know, maybe some early stage VCs or whatever, but unlikely, and they dilute down so much without thinking through, okay, well, what is going to be the downstream impact of this? I mean, we talked to a business recently, you know, where they've given, you know, 5% of their equity to someone to make introductions to potential clients. And I'm sort of sat there going, well, that's going to be a problem down the track, right? Like, that's dead equity in your business. Okay, it's relatively small today, but it's still a decent enough chunk that, you know, an investment down the track, if nothing else, they're going to question, well, what was your rationale about doing that? Like, you know, if this is a $1 billion business in 10 years time, and, you know, okay, on a diluted basis, this guy is going to take 2.5% of that, but was only with you for like 6 months of the business making a few introductions. What does that say about your judgment? And I think the same thing is there with accelerators for a lot of founders is, you know, if they do it to get a name or whatever, or they don't negotiate the kind of terms and they're not with this sort of accelerator. And some of these accelerators, well, not the best ones, but some of these accelerators have a lot of downside protection written into their kind of instruments, which actually has a future impact on these businesses' ability to fundraise, right? So I think it's that balance of understanding what you're getting into and making sure that the value that you're getting back is what you expect and frankly, what the business needs and what the founder needs, right? Otherwise, and it, you know, exactly the same point that you were talking about as an investor, you want to provide direction and advice, but give the founder autonomy. Like, actually, an accelerator should be taking that same role, because ultimately, they only also succeed if that founder down the track exceeds, one would think, right? But I think you're right. I think, you know, there is still the, you know, having the badge of YC, Entrepreneurs First, you know, those are still positive things. And I think, you know, in the ecosystem are still valued.
Yeah, especially as an accelerator, if you show up that you are being able to attract this winner from early on, yeah, that's good, you know. I mean, like you, I would like to receive this deal flow of this accelerator where I know that he usually got into the winner. If he's charging more, I mean, like you're bringing something new.
Yeah.
But yeah, some founders, they just get through an accelerator and they are unaware,
yeah,
of this 10% that you're giving,
yeah,
because they still like trying the company. It's still like 5-6 million valuation. They don't really see how big this company is going to be, and how hard it's going to be able to capture all of that again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is where like you as an investor, you should ask the founder maybe at one time to start cleaning the cap table, yeah, a bit, yeah, getting out these people that they went early on. Because every time you need to do a round, you need to go into all of these people.
Yeah.
And some of them, they can really like stop you signing.
Yeah. No, and
unless you put them in the small shareholders so they don't have this power to sign anymore. Yeah. Yeah. But there is so much on the way up that you don't need to be picking up from the early mistake,
yeah,
that you did.
Yeah. Look, and we see that like all the time. I mean, we've seen, you know, I've talked to lawyers who've had exits blocked by early EIS or SEIS investors because it's actually more beneficial for them to take the tax loss,
yes,
than it is for the, you know, so it's all these sort of things which absolutely have an impact. I mean, this has been an incredible conversation. I have one final question, which I ask all my guests, which is, do you have one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home? What is the hill that you would die on defending?
Something that I taken hard for.
Mm.
I would say healthcare.
Mm.
Yeah, I would say healthcare for middle class people doesn't really serve a lot today.
Mm.
And we should, as a human, do more there. Because when we're talking healthcare, we're talking about kids, adults, old people, even people our age. Now, as women back in time, at certain age, they didn't have some cancer problem. Today, even when you're early, when you're still young, you have cancer problem. men as well, they have some problem. You see more kids today that they just...
obese or...
Yeah, and I mean, there is no enough education around healthcare, especially that COVID really show that if you don't have good immunity system, you can get the same sickness as everyone and it can get worse on you, you know? Because it's all about your immunity system, how much we can give people to have a better healthcare system. Because, you know, when you are able to, when you have a good insurance company and you're able to afford it, you go all this prevention company that
we see. Yeah, so it's about health, it's about preventative care rather than health, than sick care, which is what we have.
But today we're already a bit behind. Yeah. We have people that they are sick. So how we can actually help these people, how we can help people instead of waiting 2-3 hours at a doctor, how we can actually help emerging market to get the right medicine, you know, with all the smart tracker, with the recording between the doctors and the patient, you know, if this patient is getting the right medicine as well. There's so much in the emerging market that we can do through healthcare, and we can just sell it for all these countries and help them. I think this is something that I really love the part of working in tech that we can do. Is like we can save people life by either finding the right medication for them, the right problem, you know, like sometimes, you know, like with things, you know, when he was pitching, I was like, how people used to do it before. I was like, well, the doctor will just ask you to walk. And based on that, they can maybe touch a bit and see like if you have a problem. And I was like, oh, really?
Okay. Completely manual. No.
And this is where we see like there is, we need some more adoption for tech. It should be healthcare. I think education should be next.
We still learn stuff like our
parents and our grandparents did, and 100 years where they didn't have all this AI or all this. I think there is, but I mean, this is tackling, this is a a hard thing. I think healthcare is more, people are more adaptable when it's touched to their health.
Yeah, I think there's, people are very highly opinionated on education. It's like, it's one thing that everyone has an opinion on. But it's interesting that you talk about healthcare. And just as a kind of parting note, I as I mentioned, I was in Kenya last week. And I was very lucky to go and I sit on the governance body of a large private enterprise. I was lucky enough to go and see their foundation. So big shout out to the MRM Foundation. You guys are doing incredible work. Small clinic, like less than 20 staff, saw 38,000 patients last year. And, you know, that's without technology, right? Like without a huge amount of technology. Now, if you could give them support, if you could give them the sort of tools that that allow them to die, you know, and they're doing cataract treatments, they've got, you know, HIV clinics, they've got TB, you know, they're screening for TB for everyone that comes in, irrespective if they're showing symptoms, because then they can pre-treat and, you know, make sure they're going out. You know, to your point, you know, these are marginalized sort of communities that don't have the access to the healthcare. And if you can improve that by 1%, you know, every year, actually the cumulative effect of that is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, instead of sending them medication when they're already sick, maybe we can just help them
stop them getting sick in the first
exactly.
place.
Exactly.
Yeah, look, I'm a very big believer in that. Maya, look, this has been an absolutely incredible conversation. Thank you so much. For our audience, where's the best place for them to find you online? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Where can they find you on the internet?
I'm on LinkedIn and I'm being more active on Twitter recently because I feel like LinkedIn is more European.
Yeah, very.
You want to read more American stuff, you go on Twitter. X today.
I struggle with X, but yeah, I completely agree. I think LinkedIn has become, like, certainly within the VC ecosystem, LinkedIn is like where everyone seems to be, whereas it's exactly the opposite in the US. Everyone's on X. But look, Maya, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate you being here. It's been absolutely wonderful.
Thank you again.